from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Before I get into today's show, I just want to briefly repeat something that I'm doing. I'm doing a book giveaway. If you're interested in one of the books that you have heard about on this show, go to my website. You may go to my website if you're interested, shelaughswithoutus.com, and use the contact tab to ask me for my copy of that book. If you're the first to ask and you live in an area with domestic United States postal rates, I will send it to you. You may ask for a recent book or an older one. If I don't have it anymore, I won't obviously be able to send it to you, but I would love to share the ones that I do have. Today on Write the Book, you will hear a conversation with the author Sarah Collins, whose debut novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton, has just come out from Harper. Of Jamaican descent, Sarah Collins grew up in Grand Cayman and studied law at the London School of Economics. She worked as a lawyer for 17 years before doing a Master of Studies in Creative Writing at Cambridge University, where she was the recipient of the 2015 Michael Holroyd Prize for Creative Writing. The Confessions of Franny Langton is an historical thriller that concerns a servant and former slave accused of murdering her employer and his wife. Moving from a Jamaican sugar plantation to the fetid streets of Georgian London, this literary debut is being compared to The Underground Railroad, The Paying Guests, and Alias Grace. Margaret Atwood herself tweeted, quote, "Reading, finally, this deep diving, elegant plus tough novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton. Wide Sargasso Sea meets Beloved meets hashtag Alias Grace meets oddly Frankenstein in a way. Scissors so handy." That was a Margaret Atwood tweet about this new book by Sarah Collins. That last comment about the scissors has to do with the plot. I'm not going to get into that, but this searing depiction of race, class, and oppression is the story of a woman of her own making in a world that would see her unmade. I spoke with Sarah Collins last week. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I know from your author's note that this book began when you read about Francis Barber, a young Jamaican boy brought to London in the 18th century and given as a gift to Samuel Johnson. So I wonder how you found Franny Langton from that starting point.
That's a good question, because it really was only a starting point. I think the part of Francis Barber's story that interested me was not only the fact that he had been given as a gift, which to me perfectly reflected the hypocrisy of high society in Georgian England at the time, the fact that so many of them prided themselves on the fact that there were no slaves in England and, you know, their sort of progressiveness, but in fact their wealth was built on slavery and it was very much the elephant in the room. But more than that, what interested me about Barber's story was the fact that he was a young Jamaican, apparently intelligent boy who was put in this position where he was rubbing shoulders with one of the greatest minds of the age. Mm-hmm. But was very much in his shadows. The only accounts we have of their relationship are from Johnson's point of view or from the point of view of Johnson's friends or colleagues, not from Barber himself. And so I think if there is a link between him and Franny, it was that idea that one of the great tragedies of slavery or of being completely dependent on someone else in the way that servitude in England would have made Barber dependent on Johnson, was this curtailing of any kind of intellectual outlet for yourself, that, you know, that there would have been so many very bright people capable in their own right who did nothing with their lives but support, you know, they were supporting acts for these men who we consider to be clever and whose ideas we've inherited. Mm. And I really wanted to explore that and the damage that that did, but I wanted to do so in the character of a woman. I felt that added a layer that was very interesting for me. And I also did not want to be constrained by Barbara's story. So it's not a reflection at all of what happened to him, and it's not nonfiction. I wanted to be free to think of things that were as dark and twisted and gothic as I could make them, and that's what I did.
Yeah, I did like that you kept his name as a sort of respectful nod to his place in history, maybe? Or
yes, exactly. And also to the idea that, you know, he was very much the inspiration for the novel. It's interesting as well, because I did an event recently. I did a reading at a bookstore in London, and someone asked me about Barbara, and I asked the audience to raise their hands if they'd heard of Francis Barber, and no one raised their hands. And I asked the same question about Samuel Johnson, and I think almost to a person, you know, everyone in the room raised their hands. And it said something to me about whose stories are kept or preserved or considered worthwhile. And that very much lines up with who is in fact writing the stories. And so I like to think that, you know, by Barbara having his biography written very well on a number of occasions now, and then perhaps by me fictionalizing the idea of his, you know, his origins, that is a way of bringing these stories to the forefront that wouldn't otherwise be told.
I also liked very much, and I'm not going to give away anything about the novel, but there is a certain irony to the fact that Franny is working for Langdon, who is her original owner, I'll say, and she's working specifically toward the cause of explaining why Negroes, as he puts it, are not as smart as whites, right? And she is very much intelligent and right in plain sight, and he cannot even see her. And I mean, that the irony of that setup was very interesting to me.
Oh, thank you. I'm actually really pleased to hear that, because it was one of the important things for me in writing the novel. And I thought, not only ironic, but in a way humorous, although it's obviously an important and depressing and infuriating point that I'm making, in a way humorous, that these men who pride themselves on being, you know, the geniuses responsible for everything, couldn't see what was under their own noses, and the fact that the maid is the most intelligent person in the room. That was my object in writing the novel, an exploration of this idea of who is considered intelligent and how important that is, what influence that has in the world, as well as how damaging it can be to have your own intelligence denied.
Right. Now, the entire novel, the narrative itself, well, most of the novel, actually, there are some interludes that aren't this, but most of it is actually Franny's confessions, or her own life story as conveyed on paper to her attorney, we would say here, lawyer.
Yes, her barrister, yes. who's defending her at the murder trial, yes.
Yes, so early in the novel, she writes, "No doubt you think this will be one of those slave histories all sugared over with misery and despair." And then she goes on to say that, no, this is my life, and my life is unique, and this is, I'm going to convey it to you. But I wonder if you can talk about what this statement means, a slave history all sugared over with misery and despair.
Yes. Part of the reason why I feel like I was drawn to write the novel is because I have always been fed up with the idea that throughout history we see only victims when we see black characters. That's one of the legacies of slavery, certainly history when it comes to the diaspora. You know, coming from my perspective as a young Caribbean person, that was certainly my experience whenever I read the history of my region or historical fiction set in my region. And it bothered me because it is a really effective denial of the full humanity of people like me. There's a marvelous quote by Hilary Mantel. She says, "The way we see our ancestors shapes the way we see ourselves." And so it seems to me to be a tragedy, really, that we are, as Black people, are stuck in this kind of perpetual victimhood. And one of the things that does that, ironically, because this was not the intention, is the existence of all of these slave narratives, because there was no scope for Black writers or Black people who were given the chance to tell their story to do anything but talk about their experiences of slavery. And so I was drawn to write historical fiction and to put a Black woman center stage in it, and therefore had to sort of address her background in slavery, which would otherwise have been the elephant in the room. But it was as if the character herself had to address this and had to say, I am not setting out to do the usual thing, the thing you expect of me. I'm not setting out to tell you the ways in which I was a victim. What I want to do is tell you a full life story, good and bad. And, you know, some of it might be challenging and infuriating, and not all of it will make me seem likable. But here you are. This is not a tale of pity and woe. And it was very important, I think, for her to say that up front. So that's what she does in the first chapter. For her, really, the important thing, and the thing that I found very compelling about her character, is that she wanted to tell us about the love that had come into her life and the love story, the romance she felt she had with her mistress in London, which may, as everyone else says, have been all in her head, but was nonetheless incredibly redemptive and powerful for her. And those are precisely the kinds of things that slave narratives will never allow any room for, and I think that's a shame.
Yeah. It just reminds me of something I remember hearing in a lecture. It was not about this subject. It was actually about why is there so much fiction that is predictable, and why does some of the fiction that gets published disappoint the people who are looking for something different? And I remember that the answer was sort of, you know, people like reading a refrain. They like what they already know. They like what they already expect. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And it gives people comfort to already sort of know how this is going to go. So I think that it's so much more interesting to offer what we don't expect, what we don't know what's going to happen.
It takes a bit of bravery on the part of the writer as well. I had this interesting experience when I was writing the book, because I knew some people would feel uncomfortable. I knew it would be challenging because I have not given Franny a kind of noble victimhood. But, you know, over time, I came to understand and appreciate, or at least I kept trying to sort of tell myself that it's the very things that require bravery that are the things that are worth writing about, because we do need to tell different stories. And I think it's important, in particular, where the stories become kind of stereotypes, that writers need to be brave enough to try and approach them from as many angles as we can.
Yeah. Now, as the story begins, Franny is about to have an Old Bailey trial. And I've read about the Old Bailey through many, you know, years of reading books that take place in England, but Americans might read this and not quite know what an Old Bailey trial is. I just wonder if you can talk about the Old Bailey for a minute.
Yeah, so it's the Central Criminal Court in London. It would have been where the great murderesses and, you know, arrested in London would have been tried in Franny's day. And so for people who are familiar with English legal history, it's one of those iconic places. The same with Newgate, which is the central prison where she's held. Mm-hmm. I don't know what an American equivalent would be, but certainly any of your big trials, if you imagine the frenzy of reporters with cameras and microphones on those grand steps with, you know, the Greek style, Palladian style columns, you know, one of those courthouses where the big trials, the big media frenzy trials would take place.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I've always thought it would be daunting to write a courtroom drama, but you actually have an education in law. Are you a lawyer?
I was a lawyer, and I think that probably made it more daunting to write a courtroom drama, because first of all, I knew people would expect me to get it right, or perhaps more accurately would be looking for the ways in which I failed to get it right. So it kind of put some added pressure on there. But the other reason is that I actually was not a criminal trial lawyer, so I never conducted a criminal trial myself. But I am the daughter of a criminal barrister, or attorney, as you would say, and so grew up watching my dad getting ready for trial, and I think part of that might have filtered into the book, as well as the reason I became a lawyer was I had this huge sense that lawyers could really fight injustice, that it was one of the most attractive professions for that reason, because you could change things and help people and, you know, save the world. It was a very young, naive, idealistic view I had on it, but a bit of that filtered into the novel as well. And then, you know, in practice, I observed many trials, although they were commercial trials, but I think the behavior of judges and lawyers in courtrooms, which are places that are driven by storytelling, but also by ego, which may be the same thing, in fact, that behavior is kind of consistent, no matter whether the trial is commercial or criminal. And so some of that crept in as well.
It's interesting, you know, as you talk about the reasons one goes into law, or the reasons you went into law, it occurs to me that, you know, it is maybe the only profession where you can go in for one reason or the other, and the other is on the complete other end. You know what I mean? It's
Yes. Like
either you're going to save the world or you're going to make a whole lot of money and not care that much about the world. I mean, and that I think also is a naive speculation. But
it's so true. It's the full spectrum of reasons why people become a lawyer. I'd never thought of it that way before, but that might explain a lot about the particular stresses of that profession.
Yeah. So you called the book a minute ago, and I'm going to reiterate, the name of the book is The Confessions of Franny Langdon, and it's published by Harper. And you mentioned a minute ago that it's historical fiction. But the book also has romance, mystery, crime, and, as we've said, courtroom drama. And to me, it was very literary. So I just wondered if you worried at all about genre as you wrote, or if you just didn't worry about it at all. Because I feel like sometimes, maybe romance in particular, scares literary writers away. And I think that can inhibit the narrative if you're frightened of a certain genre. And then also, I don't disrespect genre at all. I think that there are wonderful romances, wonderful mysteries. But anyway, if you're working in one genre, are you afraid of another? I'm just curious.
I did not have genre in mind when I was writing. And I think, okay, I don't think it's helpful to write a novel with genre in mind, unless you really are setting out to, you know, fulfill a genre contract. That's a different thing. But, you know, this was my first novel. It was very much a passion project. I read widely, literary and otherwise. I have in my time been a big fan of Regency romances, but also of this sort of more canonical Regency novels. I hate this kind of distinction between high and low brow literature. I don't think it's helpful at all, because there are technically great examples of writing in genre fiction, or so-called genre fiction, and probably just as many as there are in literary fiction. So I don't, you know, I think it's just too snobby to maintain that kind of distinction. But also, I think when you're setting out to write a novel, it's not that useful, because I don't think there's a limit to what you should be doing deliberately if you're writing a novel. So you shouldn't, for example, be saying, oh, I am going to inject some symbolism here. These are my themes. Let me make sure they appear, you know, every 10 pages or so. If you do all of that, you're stopping the magic. And I think the magic is what is coming from your subconscious. And I say, if your subconscious wants to kind of engage with this sort of mashup between mystery, romance, and courtroom, why not? Something beautiful might come of it. I'm not suggesting my own novel is, but I can think of a few novels that I think are beautiful that have mashed up several different aspects. Alias Grace being one of my favorite examples of this kind of historical genre, but that has a dash of, you know, science and spiritualism and that kind of thing in it. And there are many. I think one of the ways in which you produce that kind of work is by not inhibiting yourself, by thinking too much about what you're doing while you're doing it. You may, after you finish, then look back and think, well, where is this going to be positioned? Or, you know, am I editing it with a particular thing in mind, in particular if you've got an editor at a publishing house on board? But while you're writing it, no, I certainly didn't. I was not at all worried about genre. I might have been worried about the fact that, you know, people like my mom would be reading love scenes I've written, which is the writer's classic worry, but not about genre or whether it would be pigeonholed at all.
Right. Now, while you're talking about Elias, Grace, we just have to mention that Margaret Atwood tweet. I'm just like,
yes,
I was blown. So you got a wonderful tweet from Margaret Atwood, very complimentary of this book. And that is just fabulous. So
the wonderful thing about the tweet, I mean, so many wonderful things about the tweet. And I don't think that there will be anything coming down the pipeline that is going to make what I am about to say next inaccurate. It was the highlight of publishing this novel. I just don't think it can get better. But the most wonderful thing about it was that I sort of came across it almost by accident, because she didn't tag me. And I think it was someone in my UK publishing house, you know, many, many hours later, who sent a screenshot and said, you know, did you see this? And I actually thought, what a terribly cruel prank they're playing on me. it really was delightful, yes. And delightful also because if I had to name two authors who have been the most important sources of inspiration to me, not just in their books, but in the way they conduct themselves as writers and how they speak about their work, Margaret Atwood would be one, and Toni Morrison would be another. So it was one of those moments that I really honestly still cannot believe actually happened.
Mm. That's fabulous. Let's see. You had a number of lines in the novel that related to writing, and this show is for writers and curious readers. That's the tagline. And so a lot of writers are listening to this. I want to mention these few lines from the novel. You write, "A novel is like a long, warm drink, but a poem is a spike through the head." and then you write, "This was awesome, because I have a very visceral reaction to the term women's fiction, and I thought this was the best framing of what women's fiction should mean." You write, "A man writes to separate himself from the common history. A woman writes to try to join it." Yeah. That was so wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then there's one last one that you had many, but anyway, another one I wrote down was, "The trouble with writers is they spend their lives trying to lie to themselves." So those, I don't have a question. I just thought those were all sort of wonderful to think about.
Oh, thank you. Well, yes, especially that the bit about woman writing. It was one of the last lines I wrote. It came in during the line edits, I think, for the novel. And people do highlight that line a lot. It, you know, if a writer is allowed to have a favorite line, it might be mine. And I think it's because it also summed up how I felt about writing the novel. So it's Franny's line, but in a way it's mine as well. That we are, in many ways, as women writers, engaged in this process of trying to catch up, but doing it in marvelous fashion. And, I don't think men will ever quite grasp that point. And the other idea, which reflects one of the ideas that drove the novel for me, that we believe that these men were geniuses only because they told us they were geniuses, and they were the ones who were able to tell us because they were the ones who were writing everything down. And for me, that just sums up how much power there is in storytelling, how much unbelievable power there is. And that was what a large part of what drove Franny and kind of gave me access to her character when I was thinking about the novel.
Mm. Great. I want to talk a little bit about building suspense. One aspect of the plot is something that happens in Jamaica in a building called the Coach House on the place where she lives. I'm not going to go into detail about what happens there, but she's very troubled by what happened in that building and a role that she feels she played in a terrible thing that happened in that building. And she refers to it sort of at regular intervals without necessarily disclosing the full explanation for a long time. And it really did kind of work to build a kind of suspense around that. And interestingly, you know, I knew it was going to be horrible and I wanted to know what had happened there, but I also did not want to know what happened there. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about building suspense.
Yes. Isn't that a great definition of suspense? I wanted to know, but didn't want to know. I think that's the perfect definition. It's that kind of breathless, heart in throat feeling, which gets people turning pages. I really wanted to write a page turner, which some people might think is odd, because I also really wanted to write a novel with literary quality. And, you know, there are people who might argue that the two can't go hand in hand. I would disagree.
They can, but only very well executed circumstances.
it's hard to do, I think. So I think when you're trying to create suspense, then all you're really trying to do to make a very difficult thing sound simple is raise a question that the reader cares enough about to want to find the answer to, and raise it often enough and well enough that they will keep reading to find the answer, which means, so it's like playing a note, but having to have that note echo throughout the piece for it to resonate. And also making sure that you're not just raising one question. So, you know, some of your questions will be red herrings, but they also contribute something to this sort of symphony. And timing is crucial. It's where are you raising and where are you answering? And some questions need to be answered earlier than others in order for the reader not to lose patience. So it became, I mean, for me, it seemed to become quite a technical thing that it, you know, the effect of suspense on the reader is this sort of breathless, perhaps quick, page turning. But for the writer to create that, it's a very painstaking, deliberate, long process of thinking and plotting. And, you know, I'll tell you, it's not romantic, but I had a spreadsheet at one point just thinking about what questions was I raising and what questions was I answering and what things were left hanging and needed to be tightened up and was the pacing right? And it was all a very, very laborious process.
Mm. That's interesting. When you first said, where are you raising and where are you answering? I thought of poker and I'm like, actually, that's kind of an awesome analogy.
Yes.
What you're doing here.
That's right. And, you know, but you could also bring in the bluffing as well, because there's a lot of bluffing involved in creating suspense.
And I don't think the spreadsheet loses any romance, because I think anybody who's trying to do this well understands that there is like maybe a whole draft or several drafts that aren't working with a spreadsheet. But then you really do need to make sure that you're organized and understanding how everything is laid out. I think it's wonderful to know.
Right. And you're absolutely right that you draft first. So I had some very messy early drafts. And then when I stood back to take stock of what I had, I found I needed to map it out on my spreadsheet in order to manipulate it and work with it and shape it and make sure that the timing was right. So, right. Yeah.
Now, at one point in the narrative, Franny writes, I had no intentions. There's no way I can think to explain it. There was nothing in my mind but black terror, that awful, shrinking, grasping, shaming need to save myself. And actually, I've excerpted a couple little words out of that just to make it more clear from my question. But without addressing this particular scene or event, I want to talk about how power forces the powerless to act without intention. I thought that was a really interesting line. It was almost like she was incapable of intention because she was just protecting herself. Do you remember writing that particular line?
I do, and what a beautiful way to express it. I'm tempted, I don't have a pen, I'm tempted to write that down because it actually does sum up precisely
well,
what I
we
felt.
We are recording this, luckily.
Yes, well, that's true. I will be able to listen to myself. If I can stand the sound of my own voice, I'll listen to the podcast for it. But yes, it was what I was trying to get at. And so she's put in a position, not to spoil it, but she's put in a position where she does something terrible. And one of the questions is, did she have any choice in doing it? I was thinking at the time a lot about the fact that she was essentially captive, as was anyone who grew up on a plantation and was ostensibly owned by the plantation owner, that this life in captivity and what it would do to her sense of choice and her free will and how she would experience that. There was an element of what some might call Stockholm syndrome in her absolute desire to please this man who was essentially her captor, which leads her to do what she does in this scene. And I really wanted to examine that. I actually, when I wrote that line, had been reading a lot about experiences in the camps during the Holocaust and felt that I was getting at a very similar thing to what's described in many of the great memoirs from that period, and how being in that kind of situation strips all of your instincts away apart from one, and that's just to survive. Yeah. And how absolutely bleak that might feel. I think that's why she describes it as a kind of blackness. There really isn't anything else in your head or in your mind. She's, you know, her whole life is zeroed down to this one awful moment. And the question is whether she has any choice or not, and whether anyone in that situation did have any choice about what they did.
And I think a lot of the people who we herald as heroes in those situations, they either lost their lives or they were in a position to hide what they were doing. You know what I mean? I feel like she is, if she makes this choice the other way, there's going to be, you know, some sort of outcome, and she could lose her life. You know, I mean, and
yeah.
I think, you know, when you talk about the Holocaust and people who maybe hid people and people who helped people pass to another place, you know, or the Underground Railroad, you know, the people who were putting themselves in danger were maybe behind a couple of protective barriers. And I'm not trying to take away anything from that, but, and I also just think to be a hero takes even so much more courage than we know, because most of us luckily never are faced with.
Yes, and I think it goes back to what I said before, earlier about bravery on the part of a writer, because in a way easy is the wrong word, but it's an uncontroversial choice as a writer to write about those classic heroes, the people who were undeniably brave and to whom we owe so much, the people who did save others. It's a very brave choice to write about the people who did the other thing, who saved themselves and who carry regret. And, you know, not perhaps that's why it's not done as often, but yet isn't it just as important for us to explore if, as writers, we are in the business of thinking about all aspects of our psyche and why we do things the way we do?
Right. And presenting so, the truth.
Yes, and presenting the truth, exactly that. And so then, you know, that means, the truth means looking at both the hero and the person who is in some ways victimized by this being stripped down to not being a hero, to, you know, to actually having to live with their own cowardice. And, you know, I found that very interesting and compelling, and it was one of the things behind writing the book.
Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about So the structure of the book, as I said, is sort of structured as her confessions in sort of almost like letter form. But you also introduce important information, or surprising information in a lot of cases, in court records and newspaper stories, and often in sort of like recorded testimony from characters who we've just seen featured in previous scenes. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, you'll read a scene and you get a sense of who somebody is, and then all of a sudden here we have them testifying in court. And is it in line with who we think they are? And also, is there information being revealed that we didn't know? Can you just talk about including these little interludes in the structure of the novel?
Yes. It was, on one hand, a bit of writerly indulgence, because I loved doing that. I love novels that give you artifacts. So, you know, part of the story is told in the form of things that are made to look like newspapers or diaries or letters or, you know, contemporaneous documents. And I found it a little bit of a break for me from writing from Franny's perspective to do those documents. But also, Franny is in some ways an unreliable narrator, one of my favorite things to read. And, you know, it turned out to be a really enjoyable thing to write for me. And so the documents which present testimony or perspectives from other characters can undercut what she is saying or what we think has just happened in a scene sometimes. And they're also part of that suspense building, because if you do have independent or supposedly independent evidence that comes in that offers a different perspective or challenges what we've just been told, then you create suspense about who to believe, which of course in a courtroom drama is one of the biggest open questions. Who do we believe and who is telling the truth? And mm-hmm. So I hoped that they would all serve to generate some kind of energy about that leading up to the big trial, which really sort of occupies the latter part of the last third of the novel, but needs to be kind of kept front and center in the reader's minds even before we get there.
Well, and then we've been talking about how Franny can write, of course, and read, which offers her a kind of salvation and also a lot of trouble. I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about how reading and writing offers people freedom, and why it is controlled and why it is often forbidden, and the dangers of that.
Yeah. for me, first of all, reading has always been so personally valuable. It's the thing I have enjoyed most in my life. And the reason I became a writer was because of this lifelong obsession I had with books and the magic and the power that they have. And I feel as if I developed my sense of self through reading, but also my self-confidence, that it gave me a kind of armor to put on, especially as a Black woman navigating the world, that this ability to live inside the heads of people who transcended their circumstances was so valuable. There was such a powerful magic in that. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that led me to the creation of Franny's character was to think about what it would mean not to have had that. That would have actually been one of the things I would have lost had I been sort of whisked back to this period of time I was writing about by, you know, a magical time machine, that I would not have had access to that. And so then the question arose, well, you know, if you were a young girl with those sensibilities growing up on a plantation, what would you have done to get it? And it ends up, Franny's ability to read and her education ends up being, as she says, both the best thing and the worst thing that ever happened to her, because it does give her a sense of freedom. It enables her to see that she is just as talented or more talented than the people who are keeping her under their thumb. But at the same time, it kind of presents her this whole new world that she can't be a part of. And so that's where the terror comes in, that it's, you know, it's one of the sources of her anger. And I thought it was interesting to talk about that, how reading can both include and exclude you from the magic of the world all at the same time. It can make you aware how powerful you are internally, while also making you aware how much you're stripped of power externally. And so there's sort of the counterbalancing positive and negative effects of that, which I wanted to explore with Franny as she makes her way into English society.
Yeah, and one aspect of this in this book, but also in other situations, I think, is the white friend who not pretends, but feels they understand, and yet there is this casual lack of understanding at the same time, and that tension is in this book as well, without going into too much detail. But you know what I mean? It's like people understand that she can read, and some of the people in her life understand that she can read everything they've read and understand it even better. And yet, you know, there is this lack of appreciation for how hard that must be for her, you know?
Yes. And isn't the lack of understanding always casual in a way? Because if you don't understand, you actually won't appreciate how significant it is. And so even well-meaning people, and some of my favorite characters in the novel, people like the friend Franny makes when she moves to the household in London to work as mm-hmm. a maid, her fellow maid Prue, who was so friendly and genuinely supportive, but people who just would never be able to see the world through her eyes. And actually, that brings me back to reading. And, the thing it does, maybe the most valuable thing it does, is enable us to see the world through other people's eyes. And that is the only way in which you can connect and understand. But without that understanding, the response always is going to be casual, because we just won't know where people are coming from, will we? And I think that was the problem with some of the characters in the novel.
All right. Well, we're talking about reading and writing. I always like to ask my guests if they've read any books lately that they would recommend to listeners. So maybe two or three titles of books that you've read lately that you particularly enjoyed.
Yes. So I have just reviewed, actually, for The Guardian in the UK, Wyatu Moore's new novel, which I think is a debut novel, called She Would Be King, which is really heavily dosed with magic realism, but reimagines the birth of Liberia. So it's set in the early 19th century, and there are three protagonists who have supernatural powers who come together in Monrovia, and there's this sort of epic showdown at the end with, in the context of the European assault on Africa. And I thought it was a very refreshing take on something that I had not seen dealt with in that way before in fiction, in particular because of the magic realism. So I would highly recommend it.
Oh, wonderful.
I've actually also just started reading, and I'm only on page 47, which shows you how good the book is that I'm going to recommend it, because I think it will be one of my favorite reads this year. It's by a novelist called Sophie Hardack. It's called Confession with Blue Horses. And it's about a family who flees East Berlin, but then has to leave, in mysterious circumstances, the little brother behind. It's about the adult siblings looking back and going on a search. So the contemporary part of the novel follows the adult siblings on their search to find their lost brother in Berlin. But it's just started as an absolute cracker. I think it's going to be brilliant. A novel I read in proof, which I think, I'm not actually sure when it's coming out in America, but it's going to be well worth it. It is by a French novelist, Philippe Besson, and was translated by Molly Ringwald, an impeccable translation, a really, really good translation. It's called, I think, Lie With Me. I don't have it. I hope I'm not misremembering the title, but it is about, it's a coming-of-age story about a romance between two young boys in a French town in, I think, the 1980s, and it's very short, but a really beautiful and beautifully written love story, and definitely one of my novels of the year.
And has it already come out in France?
I think it's already out in France, and so the translation I know is due to be published in the UK in September, and I think maybe sometime this year in America as well, and well worth looking out for.
Oh, excellent. We'll watch for that. And then... And then, Sarah, what are you writing now? Are you writing anything new, or are you waiting until after this book tour is over?
I am. It's very difficult to write a new thing when the old thing is still in your head, I've discovered. So I have an idea that's pulling at me for a novel about a cult in the Caribbean. It's actually a sort of suicide cult in the Caribbean set in the 1980s. But the problem is I do have to clear Franny out of the way, and Franny has been optioned for television, and I've been hired to write the scripts for the TV episodes.
Oh, your life is not at all exciting right now.
It does seem a bit, you know, it does seem a bit like a dream. So I think I have to, so I'm doing both, but I think I will really only get sunk into the novel when I have finished with those, which I hope will be towards the end of the year.
Great. Now, you're from the Caribbean. What age were you when you left there?
So my family left Jamaica when I was 4, and we moved to Grand Cayman in the Cayman Islands where I grew up. But I left Grand Cayman to come to school in England when I was 11. So I went to boarding school and did all of my qualification here. But I actually went home to work. So I worked there for many years as a lawyer, and then recently came back to England about 4 years ago. So
and
I've been moving between the three places all my life. Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. So do you mind, I want to read a paragraph, and then I have a kind of, I don't know if it's a hard question, but I don't know how I would answer it if I were you, but anyway.
Well, that's created some suspense.
Good luck. do you mind if I read a paragraph from the book?
No, of course not. Go right ahead.
Okay. So this is a moment right after Franny has sort of realized that she's starting to fall in love. Okay. There was a fair just beside the gates. I remember, and the three of us walked through it. Chestnuts and cider spiced the air. Boards covered with paper spoke of mermaids, two-headed men, fire-eaters. Tops spun like wind. We stopped to watch a tightrope walker, a rat frisking across a shorter rope strong beneath him. From a tent to the right of us, a man with an elephant tied with a length of hemp. An elephant. I'd seen a picture of one before in a book written by a naturalist, but reading about something can never be the same as seeing it. The gray leathery wave rearing up, and then the quiet crash, the giant-legged curtsy. The people at the front hopped backwards, made a show of bringing their hands up to their mouths, shrieking laughter. Some people love to be frightened in a crowd, tossing fear around like a hot potato. Step up, ladies and gentlemen, the man cried. All creatures, little or large, fall under man's dominion. So This was so beautiful, this prose. I mean, your prose is just gorgeous, I need to say that. Throughout the book, it was so lovely. But this moment where Franny is just realizing she's falling in love, and it seems like her sensibilities awaken, and she sees this extraordinary sight and describes it in such detail. And then that ending pronouncement, which is so eerie, about creatures falling under man's dominion. This is the hard question. I feel like it's very hard to talk about. I was going to ask you for advice for writers on achieving that level of prose, the beauty. And it's a really hard question because it's so individual. And yet I've never asked this question before. But, you know, I just feel like you nailed that. And I wondered, you know, what you did to work that moment, if unless it just came very organically. But
I wish it did. First of all, thank you. I'm smiling because it means so much to hear that. Thank you so much. And I'm also smiling because only I will ever know what terrible shape that passage was in until it wasn't. So I suppose part one of the answer to your question is that it will not, or at least it does not for most of us, unless we're real geniuses, come out that way the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, that passage was worked and reworked and reworked, and I think I may have submitted it for something in a different form where it was very clunky. You know, even the rat frisking across the rope, I remember the rat being in, the rat being out, the rat being back in. So part two and part three. Part two, I think, for me, was one thing that really opened my eyes up to tackling, especially writing about setting, was that for a long time I'd been doing it sort of dynamically. I'd been thinking about the setting and the character as two different things. And I read somewhere, I can't remember where, that that the only way to make setting come alive is for you to write your character moving through it. So that there has to be an emotional charge to bringing the setting in, otherwise you don't do it. And so you've hit the nail on the head. For me there, that's the moment just after Franny's encounter with this woman she's attracted to. So everything is more vivid. She smells things, she hears things, she sees things in a different way. And as soon as I connected with that idea, there was a spark then. There was access to how I could think about language and emotion that was going to make that come off the page more than it had for many, many months when I was trying just to write that one scene. And then the sort of part three, which is connected with that, is that I very early on realized that if I read poetry every day, that it would somehow infect my own writing. Mm-hmm. And so one of my writing rituals was to start with poems, and that, you know, I love Mary Oliver and Ocean Vuong and Kai Miller, to name a few. And so I'd have some anthologies just sitting on the desk, and before I got started, I would start with poetry and music. And it seemed to give me this kind of well of language, especially for writing setting, where, you know, it would punch up your own work when you got to it. And, I found it transformed the quality of my writing. If there's anything effective about it, then I attribute a lot of it to that. But it does not come straight away, and it does not come without a lot of work. And let me tell you, it doesn't come without, at least for me, without wanting to give up, because the first drafts were so terrible that it always does feel like it will never get better until it does.
Mm. How long did it take you to write the book?
It took me just over 2 years, but that was because I signed with an agent before I finished it, and I was conscious of her waiting and, you know, wanting to give her something, not wanting to miss my shot, as they say, so wanting to give her something as quickly as I could. I would have taken 5 years to write it, but I had to just hurry up and get it done.
Well, it worked out okay.
It did so far, thank you.
Okay, good. Well, I'm going to mention again, The Confessions of Franny Langdon is a novel by Sarah Collins, published by Harper. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I really enjoyed the book and speaking with you about it.
Thank you so much for this interview. It's been great fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV. org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with the author, Sarah Collins. More information about her work can be found on Twitter, and she tweets at Mrs. MRS, Janie, J-A-N-E-Y, Mac, M-A-C, all one. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Sarah Collins. An older woman is angry that a pair of teenagers keeps collecting rocks and shells from the beach on which she lives. Write a scene in which she confronts them for the first time. She never tells them why it distresses her so much, nor do the teenagers tell her why it's so important to them to collect the shells, though the reader comes to understand. Write the scene first from the perspective of the old woman, and then from one of the teenagers. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. That's a good one. I'm looking forward to giving that one a shot. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know archived episodes are available on iTunes and also at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm going to finish up by just announcing my book giveaway one more time. If you're interested in one of the books that you've heard about on the show, you may go to my website, shelaughswithoutus.com, and use the contact tab to ask me for my copy. If you are the first to ask, if you live in an area with domestic U.S. postal rates, and if I still have the book, I will send it to you. I will pay for the shipping. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.